Welcome to the Productivity Podcast. Today we're joined by Steve Dennis, President and Founder at Sageberry, keynote speaker, retail influencer, and author of a brilliant book I've just read called Remarkable Retail. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Simon. How are you?
Very good. Thank you. Very good. Now, I'm not sure there's many people that don't know who you are, but there may be a few. So it'd be good if you could tell us a bit about yourself, a bit of a career biography of how you've got to where you are, and then we'll get into the conversation.
Sure. Well, I guess I'd say it's been a long and winding road. Sometimes I get asked by people to who want to emulate my career, and I definitely try to disabuse them of that notion because it was not very planned. But I did spend probably about 20 years or so in executive roles, first in a CPG company and then with a couple of large retailers. The last retailer where I had a C-level position was the Neiman Marcus Group, where I was the chief strategy officer and head of multi-channel marketing and a few other things. But for the last 10 or 11 years, I've been out on my own doing strategy consulting, mostly in the retail industry. And then over the last few years in particular, I've been doing a lot more writing and speaking. I'm a senior Forbes contributor. And as you mentioned, I wrote a book last year, or came out this year, but finished up last year in the pre-COVID times.
So we're going to open with the opening line from the book, because I think it really resonates with me being a fellow retailer, and I think we'll set the conversation up brilliantly. So the opening line of the book is, physical retail isn't dead, boring retail is. So when you coined that phrase, what made you get there? How did you get to those words?
Well, it's really a couple of things. One was I became, and I'll try to make some distinctions as we go through here between what was going on pre-pandemic and some of the things that might have changed. But certainly before the pandemic, there was this growing narrative of a retail apocalypse and this idea that physical retail was going away. And I think there's lots of reasons just to realize that that's nonsense. One is that until this year, at least in the United States, but I think it's true of quite a lot of other markets, that physical retail was still growing. It was just growing much less quickly than e-commerce was. Second, there's many retailers that are still opening stores, quite a lot of stores. And in most major markets, physical retail is still in the vicinity of 80-85% of total sales. So this idea that physical retail was going away just didn't comport with the facts. And one of the ironic things was that many of these companies, the so-called digitally native vertical brands that were founded largely on this idea that you could build brands completely online, were actually starting to open stores and opening quite a lot of them. And of course, you have Amazon and others that are getting into physical retail. So I think broadly speaking, this idea that physical retail was going away was just nonsense. But what was happening is that retailers that could not adequately differentiate themselves, what I call these retailers that for the most part are trapped in the boring middle, they were absolutely going away or closing most of the stores. And when you actually look at the facts, almost all the store closings were concentrated with a very small number of retailers that had essentially the same kinds of issues.
So it's that drive to be different, to keep up with trends or even set the trends, that's really going to keep them alive. And I'll coin some phrases and I'm sure you'll cringe at some of them. So that there's omnichannel, multichannel, experiential, we hear a lot of in the UK, about people trying to be different or use the bricks and mortar as a different way of engaging people. And one of the chapters in the first part of the book that is called The Collapse of the Middle, and the bit you referred to before. And again, I really like the language in that, because if I use the UK as an example, that middle in the UK is pretty much young fashion, I think, for us. Most of the retailers that aren't here as we record today, their demise has admittedly been sped up by the pandemic, but that's not the cause of it. They were low price, low margin, high volume retailers with lots of stores, some not even with an online channel or a very early stages of an online channel, that have felt the demise. And I think it's too easy to say that is the, you know, like you say, retail's dying, that's the end of retail. They were the boring retailers. is the reality.
When I get into the collapse of the middle, the core thing there, as we look at retailers, there's some other things going on in the middle too. But I think if you look at the last 15 or 20 years, but particularly the last few years, even before the pandemic, what we saw was this, what I often refer to as a bifurcation. I think in the UK, it's maybe more popular to say polarization. But essentially, we were seeing success at either end of the spectrum. So one end of the spectrum were retailers, online or otherwise, that were mostly about value, price, convenience, efficiency, et cetera. So whether you're talking about an Amazon or you're talking about Walmart or hypermarkets or so forth, the other end of the spectrum would be retailers that are more high-end luxury or really focused on a more specialized niche. And if you actually look at the data across the last 5, 6, 7 years, it's pretty clear that there's good growth at either end of the spectrum. But if you isolate yourself or you isolate on the middle, these retailers that aren't really the lowest price or don't have the most efficiency or they don't have good service or they don't have unique product and so forth, that's really where the action has been and where the bankruptcies and store closings are. You know, you can find a few exceptions because of poor management or whatever. But broadly speaking, you don't see significant challenges at either end of the spectrum. So the thing that I tried to drive to in the book, particularly in the first part, is this idea that you have to pick a lane. You have to go broadly and or confidently in one of those directions, get out of the middle because it's just an untenable place to be. And then certainly, to your point, when the pandemic came, it just really accelerated a lot of trends we've been seeing for the last number of years.
Mention the word channel there. In the UK, there seems to be this big drive to put something in a channel. So it's multi-channel, it's omni-channel. And we probably lose sight of, and I think that's more from a hierarchical and segmentation in an organization. So I work in the online channel or I work in the operations channel.
Yeah.
But actually, have we lost sight of the fact that from a customer, we don't shop in a way that thinks this is the channel I'm shopping in?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's funny. And I tell this story in the book. In 1999, I was put in charge of Sears's multi-channel integration efforts. And as many of your listeners probably know, Sears was at one point the biggest retailer in the world. I think at that time we were about number three, and the company barely exists anymore. But one of the things that was pretty obvious to us was that e-commerce was going to radically change the shopping experience. But the other thing that we saw pretty early on was that the customer was the channel, that our job was to show up and take care of them however they chose to shop. And so I, pretty early on in that work, and then subsequently when I led some of those efforts at the Neiman Marcus Group, this whole idea of channels just always seemed to me to be pretty foolish because I've never heard customers talk about channels. I mean, certainly customers can tell you that I went to the store or the package was delivered to my home or whatever. But most of the multi-channel, omni-channel retailers that I know for years have seen customers go back and forth between channels, that great brick and mortar presence drives your online business and vice versa. And it's only become more pronounced. And I think particularly through COVID, but even before that, customers go back and forth on their mobile devices between retailers, between what we would call channels in a nanosecond. So I just think we get too hung up on that description, but even more significantly, too many retailers are still organized that way and count their sales and have their performance incentives aligned to channel rather than customer. And I think that really keeps you from seeing what you need to do. And in many cases, you're just fighting amongst yourself as opposed to taking care of the customer and fighting with the competition you need to fight with.
It's interesting. I still have lots of conversations with retailers where they will focus still on store sales, so physical bricks and mortar sales. The savvy ones are kind of taking that out of the environment now, and it becomes on purchase within postcodes. So you can influence people to buy from the brand that don't necessarily come buy from your physical store, but you've still had an impact on that customer through a conversation, a demonstration, whatever that might be. And I suppose the bigger play with all of that is back to your point, does it matter where they buy, online, in-store, through a concession, through a partner, as long as they're buying with you and not your fierce competition?
Well, that for sure should be the singular focus. It's probably worth spending a little bit of time. I was talking to somebody the other day about this idea of, I mean, because generally speaking, for a lot of retailers, if all you do is move a customer from your physical store channel to online, that may be at a lower profit, which yep. we want to get into more we can. But you know, just like you might merchandise an aisle of your store in such a way to improve your profits, I think you can perhaps merchandise your overall business to the most profitable channels. But having said that, I think customers are going to do what customers want to do. And there's only so much that you can influence the channel in which they purchase. I think you should be customer focused first and foremost. The operating principle should be to be channel agnostic. There may be some things around the edges to try to manipulate, so to speak, their behavior a little bit to profitability. But overall, the channel distinctions, I think, are not particularly important. And in most cases that I have access to data, I've seen some pretty harmful kind of intramural warfare that goes on for companies that stay stuck in these silos.
Yeah. And it'll be interesting to see in the future state of the world if we move back to more bricks and mortar specials rather than online specials to drive people back into high street stores, department stores, so that the specials become a reason to visit rather than, I think it was when it first panned out, the other way around, if everything was an online special.
Yeah. Well, I think in general, companies, the better companies are getting a much richer understanding of the interaction between what we would call channels. I think, you know, it's very hard to know exactly. I mean, it's obvious that we've had this massive shift to more online shopping and more digital influence in general. I think, you know, it remains to be seen how that's all going to shake out over the longer term. But I think it's certainly, you know, you really need, in many cases, if you're historically a predominantly brick and mortar retailer, I think it's helpful to think of your physical store as kind of the hub of your brand in a given trade area, and sorting through the role of the store in taking care of your customers, I think is evolving pretty quickly, because I'm sure it's going on in the UK. It's going on a lot in the US. You've got online, you know, buy online, pick up in store or curbside pickup. You've got many cases, retailers fulfilling orders from their store, online orders from their store. And so the role of the store has been evolving. It's just evolving a little bit more quickly by virtue of the pandemic. So I think there's going to be a pretty significant rethink of store footprints, as well as the interrelationship between the digital and the physical channels.
And in the second part of the book, you focus on the 8 essentials to have a remarkable retail organization. So I'll quickly whiz through them and then we'll circle back on a few, if that's okay.
Sure.
So 1, digitally enabled; 2, human-centered; 3, harmonized; 4, mobile; 5, personal; 6, connected; 7, memorable; and 8, radical. So if I just focus on the last two, memorable and radical, it'd be good if you could elaborate a little bit more on the kind of things that you're suggesting or thinking in those areas for people to stick in the memory and drive advocacy.
Sure. So just one quick framing thing. So of the 8, the first 6, I think, are increasingly becoming table stakes. In other words, if you aren't pretty proficient at them, you risk falling behind. Then I talk about 7 and 8 as really the opportunities for many retailers to differentiate themselves. So the idea of memorable, I think, really, in a lot of ways, ties back to the fundamental premise of the book. And the reason why I call it remarkable retail, which is that it's increasingly harder in a world of abundant choice and information and competition and so forth to get the customer's attention, much less enroll them in your brand and keep coming back. And so it's this idea that you have to create powerful emotional stories with your brand for your core customers. And then hopefully that's such a powerful experience that they will share that with their friends and colleagues, and you get kind of the proverbial word of mouth effect. So memorable really sinks at the heart of this, or sits at the heart of this. What are those things we're doing to create this memorable experience? So how are we not only unique, but incredibly customer relevant, create this enduring story? But I think the thing that really pops in memorable is, how do you amplify the wow? What is it about your product or service or the whole experience that really sets you apart from the competition and causes you to spread that story? So, you know, that can play out. I mean, depending upon what sort of retail you're in, that can play out in a lot of different ways. You know, it could be a very as we said earlier, kind of experiential thing. It could be ultra frictionless kind of experience. So there's lots of different ways. And I go through, I don't know, probably 20 or 30 examples in that chapter. Radical is fundamentally about creating a culture of experimentation and just innovating in a much more profound, comprehensive and rapid way. Because I think the two big points I make in the book, which tie to these two essentials, is that even very good is not good enough anymore, that you truly have to be remarkable if you're going to fight and win in this world. But you also have to be really increasing the pace of innovation, because that's at the heart, I think, of most retailers' success. But because the world is changing so quickly, and because it's so hard to predict, you really have to build an innovation engine to not only bring ideas forward in the short term, but to keep doing it time and time again.
And one of the things I've been thinking around in these two areas as well is collaboration. Yeah. So we're seeing much more collaboration across retail and outside of retail. So retail with hospitality, or retail with car manufacturers, for example, we've seen over here. So back to, I think it probably sits in radical, that breaking down the barriers between industries and sectors to find interesting, innovative ways to bring brands you'd never have thought would sit under the same roof together. I don't know if that, something, things like that are starting to come to light in America.
Yeah, I think we've been seeing this for a while. So I touch on this in a few different ways in the book. One is this, I mean, I think there are lots of ways to get to innovation. And I think it's often quite arrogant, you know, to think that we could only generate innovation from within our company. So whether that's seeking ideas from other places that you could bring into your company, or more to your point, finding these interesting collaborations, I think that's just a way to get better ideas and accelerate their commercialization. I think the other piece, which is what you're saying, points to, and I touch on this in a few places across the book, is I think more and more the consumers are looking for a solution. You know, they're looking for the end job to be done, as some other folks have talked about. You know, this idea that people don't buy a drill because they want a drill. They buy a drill because they want a hole. Or you could even say, you know, they want a hole so they can put up these shelves to have this fabulous home office or whatever. You know, it's this end state that customers are aiming for in a lot of cases. And I think from an innovation standpoint, if you understand that end state that the consumer is going after, you may see different ways to solve the problem. But if you define your business as being in, you know, I only sell fitness bikes, so why would I want to sell other kinds of fitness applications or clothing or whatever? Well, maybe the customer really wants just to be healthier overall. And if you can provide a one-stop solution enabled by mobile technology that helps that, fantastic. And you may sell the bikes, but you need, you know, an apparel partner or whatever to provide the whole solution. So I think that way of thinking, particularly because of the connectivity, you know, it's much, just much more easy to connect companies, but it's also easier to connect different applications and products through the Internet of Things. There's just a lot more possibilities today to provide that complete solution. And I think from an innovation standpoint, yeah, you absolutely should be looking at creative partnerships that will allow you to provide a better solution and maybe lock that customer into your product or service.
And I think there's also, we're seeing a big drive almost above that of people buying into brand value. So the social, the climate, the environmental aspects that they offer things. We've got On Running have just launched a trainer subscription. So they make trainers out of some the name escapes me, but it's a type of bean. And when you've done so many miles in those trainers, you send them back and they recycle them. It's carbon neutral and you get a new pair. So people are buying into, I think, things at a higher level, if that makes sense, rather than the physical or the material or the digital bit. There's much more of a social play, economic play, and environmental play, which is really making some of those people feel different or be more memorable or radical in terms of, you know, guess what? This subscription is great, carbon neutral, get your trainers, they're brilliant, but you're not damaging the environment at the same point.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that has been true for a while is this idea, and I think it's often, this quote's often attributed to Steve Jobs, that people don't buy products, they buy better versions of themselves. And I think it's, I tell the story in the book about the guy who started Revlon, it's Charles Revson, who talked about cosmetics being hope in a jar, you know, that the product gives the consumer a different feeling about themselves, right? It's not just literally about the technical aspects of the product. So I think in general, for many brands, particularly more premium brands, it's been true that people buy the story before they buy the product. And then the question is, well, what's the story you want to tell about yourself or you want to present to the world? So I think that's always been an important part of marketing and branding. I think what's changed a lot over the last few years is the interest or elevated interest in more purpose-driven sorts of causes. And I'm not enough of a anthropologist or whatever to be able to explain all the forces that go into that. But I think certainly we see literally that we are more connected. And I think and obviously things like climate change and other issues in the world have gotten worse, and there's more news about it. And so I think people attach themselves to causes, whether it's sustainability or ending, forced labor in the products that are manufactured and stuff. I think all those things have been elevated, which is great for society. And it definitely creates opportunities for brands to meet those customer needs in different ways and differentiate themselves.
Yeah, and we've done a couple of podcasts on purpose. Some of the guys we work with, that's, you know, their life is helping develop purpose for organizations. So not just mission statements or nice words. And yeah, absolutely. I think those brands that have a great purpose and live it and breathe it, I think that's the important bit. You've got to live to those values of the purpose. It'll have a even greater foothold over the coming months, weeks, and years to drive performance.
Yeah, I think, there's a lot of gimmicky things that go on sometimes. And one of the other things I talk about in Memorable is that you have to be authentic, which, you know, a lot of people say that. But I think part of the authenticity is it's not just a marketing slogan or something that looks good in an ad, but it's really intrinsic to your brand. I think eventually consumers see past the gimmicks and they want to know that they're really doing something important. The thing I was just going to mention quickly that's kind of points it remarkable overall, but I think also is creating these opportunities for some of these niche brands is I think we're seeing a lot more fragmentation in the market. And so it's enabling consumers to get more easily matched with smaller brands. You know, it used to be pre-internet basically that, you know, if you couldn't get distribution in a big superstore or whatever, that, you're either like a mom and pop shop or you're a big chain or you're selling to the big chains. There, it was a lot harder to get above just the minimal volume. And the long tail of the internet allows customers with very particular interests to find brands and companies that go into very particular market niches. And so I think that makes creates a lot of new opportunities for consumers, creates a lot of new opportunities for startups. And it actually, I think, chips away at the hegemony or whatever you want to call it of some of these massive brands because these competitors are just picking off small pieces of their business and kind of challenging this kind of peak of the bell curve focus that a lot of the bigger brands have. So I think that's putting some interesting pressures on legacy retailers and legacy brands. And it's also creating some new innovation opportunities. I think, you know, given the pandemic and just some of the forces, it's a little bit harder to see that right now. But I suspect as we get into the latter part of next year and beyond this, the rise of these kind of special, not big brands, I think we'll be elevated. And, you know, a lot of innovation tends to happen during a crisis as well. So who knows what that will look like, but I suspect we'll see a lot more of it in the next year or two.
Yeah. And the various social media channels are great for that. So certainly places like Instagram, where you can follow the person that makes the custom hat or scarf for the winter for you, or the artist that you like the painting, and you can see the stages of it being made. There's a real personal connection with the creativity of those people and those more niche things that you can stay in touch with and see the journey of it being made. It's really really interesting, especially if you kind of buy in again to their niche brand. You can see it cradle to grave to a degree.
Yeah, and I think that's a great example of more literally what I mean by remarkable. This idea that, well, it's remarkable and that it's distinctive, but to borrow from Seth Godin, the way he talks about it in his book Purple Cow, is that something so moves you or so interesting or meets your needs in such a special way that you literally remark about it. And I think platforms, you know, TikTok, Instagram, whatever, you know, there's all sorts of different ways for people to find like-minded folks out there on the internet, and then amplify their stories. And so the way you can build a following of, you know, pretty significant size, if you're not trying to be the next multi-billion-dollar brand, you know, it's just really different than it was, I would say, even 5 or 6 years ago. So yeah, it creates a lot of really interesting opportunities. And it's harder for, I think, big brands to respond to that because, you know, some of their requirements for volume and profitability, or just their agility to respond to these niches as they develop is often limited.
Yeah, I've still not quite got my head around TikTok yet. Instagram I can do, Twitter, Facebook, yeah, TikTok. I must be in that age bracket of it's probably just I'm not their target audience, I suspect, at all, but struggling with TikTok.
Yeah, well, one of the points you may recall making the book is it's okay to decide that some aspect of the market or some consumers, you know, that it's not the right fit. You know, I think it's okay to walk away in some cases. And I think, Simon, you probably have to work on your dance moves if you've got a...
Yeah, exactly.
I was going to say that probably seems to be the unifying principle.
Probably not targeting me is anyway. So I don't think I'm missing out, and I'm sure whoever's on TikTok isn't missing out on me dancing at all.
So it works out.
Yeah, exactly. So we probably can't leave the podcast without having a quick chat about Amazon. I speak to people and they're very polarized about you should almost go against Amazon and not follow them. Others say absolutely they lead the way on some stuff, so why wouldn't you follow them and ride the crest of the wave with them? What's your view? Are they a good influence in the world or not so good?
Well, I think it's mixed. I think anytime you have a retailer, well, any force, you know, whether it's Google, Facebook, you name it, a lot of the tech brands that get criticized for having too much power, I think they got there because they brought a lot of value, but they at the same time maybe hold too much power. So I would say, broadly speaking, I would say that about Amazon. You know, I think an Amazon strategy, if you're going to be a more premium brand where it's important for you to control to the best you can all the aspects of the consumer experience, I think being on Amazon long term is probably not the way you want to go, which I think is why Nike and others have pulled back from there, because they don't need the distribution footprint and they don't need to build awareness. They need to be able to be sure as much as they can they deliver a remarkable experience. And Amazon just controls a lot of things that is never going to happen for you in partnering with Amazon. I think if you're trying to build awareness and reach in distribution, and it's not so central to your brand promise to be, you know, a particular sort of experience, I think it's a great way to get to some scale. So I think it's very particular to the type of retailer or type of brand you are, where you are in your growth journey. I mean, if Amazon controls access to the customer that you want, it's pretty hard to ignore them. And very few brands are going to be able to out Amazon or muscle their way past them. Maybe over time, you know, but so I think it's, you certainly, it's hard to ignore Amazon, but I think you need to be careful because Amazon cares about Amazon. They don't necessarily care about your brand, and and I don't mean this in to be snotty about it. I mean, things, you know, if I were Neiman Marcus, I would say, yeah, we care about our vendors, but ultimately we care about our associates and our customers and our shareholders. And we're going to do the thing that advance our brand, not to be overly caretaking about the brands that sell to us. So, but you know, it's just hard to ignore their power, and influence. And I think you probably know, I've seen different numbers, but something like 50% of all online product searches start at Amazon, not in the search engine or at the retailer's site. So when you've got that kind of dynamic, it's pretty hard not to think super carefully about whether you need to distribute there. Probably the bigger question is how to do it, not necessarily whether you should, you know, black and white answer, yes or no.
Yeah. Well, I'll quote Spider-Man or Peter Parker, with great power comes great responsibility.
And exactly.
Some of those brands you've mentioned there, I think some of them have that. Some of them maybe haven't recognized the power that they have yet, and therefore the responsibility that comes with it. So again, as ever, time will tell. And I'm sure if we reflect on this in as little as 12, 18 months, there'll be some things that that have come to fruition and some other stuff that blindsides us that we've not even thought about. If you'd have talked to us both, I'm sure, this time last year and said there'll be a global pandemic, we'd have probably laughed you out of town, but we are where we are.
Yeah, you know, I guess last thing I'll say on that, because I get asked a lot about whether I would have written the book differently if I knew about the pandemic. And in some cases, I can't ignore the fact that it happened and has reset a lot of things and accelerated a lot of points. But, you know, it's been pretty clear, I think, for a long time, some of the underlying dynamics of retail, many of which we talked about here. And I think the lesson going forward is really to try to understand what the playing field is likely to look like going forward, to really delve deeply into customer journeys and then, you know, find those places where you can really be remarkable. There's going to be lots of things that come and go. Lots of predictions that people make, myself included, turn out to be wrong. Nobody has a working crystal ball, as it turns out. And I think the singular lesson probably from the pandemic, other than the general unpredictability of our lives, which is probably a different podcast, is the need to just be much more agile. I think that was a good idea going into the pandemic, but I think that's particularly going to be important as we hopefully start to come out of it over the next year or so.
Yeah, no, I agree. And hopefully in some boardrooms, they're asking themselves the questions around, you know, would we be able to survive another pandemic? Potentially there could be more in the future. Let's hope not. But this one's given us the data, the benchmark for how these things seem to transpire, how they work from an economic point of view and a people point of view. And I suspect if you answer the question no, that gives you a pretty good feel of you're sat in the difficult middle, I suspect.
So, yeah, I think I've given a lot of thought to that in particular. I think the really vexing thing for me in going down that path is, you know, no one's ever going to be completely prepared for such a massive, you know, so-called black swan event, right? Like if you said to yourself, well, okay, on the 1 in 1,000 chance that we have what ended up happening, what would we have done? And what that would lead you to, I think, is certainly to build in agility and contingency plans and all that kind of stuff. But for many retailers, the only way to have withstood this pandemic, absent any government aid, would have been to stockpile a lot of cash and to have been fundamentally more risk averse. And then I think they would have gone out of business because of being irrelevant. So it's difficult, I think, for individual companies, brands to protect against these huge global risks. So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, I think not to get political about it, but I think, you know, it demands much more of a government sort of response and safety net. Because I think, you know, a given company can only do so much to protect against some cataclysmic event, whether it's a tornado or a pandemic or a terrorist event or, you know, whatever horrible thing might happen, hopefully doesn't. So, yeah, it's going to be, I think people will be, I think it's going to take a while for a lot of these effects to play out, both in the corporate world as well as the policy world.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So final question from me, Steve. I've really enjoyed the chat. What's been the best bit of business advice you've ever been given?
This may not be where you're going. I think the best piece of business advice, which is probably also the best piece of personal advice, is it's not about you. You know, not to take things too personally, that what often looks like a calamity will likely pass. So it's a little bit of, you know, focus on what you can control and don't get too wrapped up on things that are outside of your control or probably very much of the moment. It's a little bit harder to take that advice in a pandemic, which just keeps going on and on. You know, I think it works better when you have a bad meeting or a presentation or something doesn't go the way you want to. You can just kind of move on from that. But it's a little harder to internalize that when we've got, you know, such a crazy world we live in.
Wise words, though, and ones to reflect on. I like those a lot. Steve, it's been an absolute pleasure. If people want to reach out to you and have additional chats or talk to you about any of the bits in the book, where's the best place for them to reach you?
Sure. Well, the best place to learn about me is on my website, which is www.stephenpdennis.com. It's Stephen with a V, not a PH. And they can also shoot me an email at steve@sageberryconsulting.com.
Cool. And they can find you on LinkedIn as well, can't they, if they're on there?
Oh, yeah. Platform. I'm all over. I think somebody told me that if you Google Steve and retail, I do pretty well in search engines, but I haven't checked that in a while. So that might be fake news, as we like to say in the US.
Good stuff. Listen, it's been a pleasure to catch up as always. Look after yourself and take care.